This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. And this is Talk Louisiana. And coming in just a moment, we're going to visit with Stephanie Grace, the talented columnist for The Advocate. She's been with the newspaper of record in Louisiana for the last 4 years. And prior to that, she worked for the Picayune in New Orleans for 18 years from the Boston area originally. And each day on this show and throughout the day on WRKF, we strive to provide the best in local, national, and international programming, hearing voices of all kinds from all sides of the political spectrum and from all races and ethnic backgrounds. And that's what makes this such a special place. And your support is essential. This is the third day of the fall membership drive, and we're asking for your support. And if you can do it this hour, that's even better. 855-893-9753. Your number is 855-893-9753 to make a contribution, and one that is much needed, because about half of the contributions that come to the station in any way, shape, or form come from listeners, members like you. And you can always go to WRKF.org. And our number for the show is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633. And you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Stephanie Grace has been writing prolifically of late about our senior U.S. Senator, William Morgan Cassidy, who grew up in Baton Rouge, native of the Chicago area, is Senator Cassidy. And for many years, he was an accomplished physician, worked at Earl K. Long Hospital for much of his career. But as we know, he became a state senator, then a U.S. congressman, and finally elected to the U.S. Senate in 2014, defeating Mary Landrieu. And his principal issue was repealing and replacing Obamacare. And Senator Cassidy has strived to do that, but has been unsuccessful to this date to have a bill that is supported by the majority of the United States Senate. Stephanie Grace has been covering the congressman's maneuvers and the congressman, now senator's, maneuvers. And on his 60th birthday, Stephanie, do you think Senator Cassidy is a happy camper?
Well, happy birthday to Senator Cassidy. Let's start by saying that. And I'm guessing it's not the happiest birthday he's ever had. This thing, you know, there's still talk of reviving it. The president yesterday strangely insisted that they did have the votes, when, of course, if they had the votes, they would have voted. But I think most of the Senate has indicated, most of the GOP leadership, certainly in the Senate, has indicated that they're ready to move on.
Well, Senator Cassidy has tried, and this is a man who has had an evolution in his life as far as his viewpoints. Many of us knew Senator Cassidy before he became a lawmaker, and he, for all intents, was a liberal Democrat in those days who supported Kathleen Blanco. Now he has become a conservative Republican lawmaker. Based on your knowledge of him, what has caused this evolution in thought for the senator?
Well, of course, I'm not in his head, but and I will say there's even been an evolution kind of over the course of the summer from the first bill he pushed to this most recent one, which, you know, the first one, which supposedly did meet the, quote, Jimmy Kimmel test. We can talk about that later. But, you know, he became a Republican, as many politicians in the state did. You know, I can't speak to his philosophical underpinnings, but, you know, strategically, that is something that many other people like him did at the time as the state was becoming more Republican. He entered Congress, he entered the Senate, certainly, when repeal and replace, repeal, even before replace, was the kind of mantra, and he was very good at it. I mean, if you remember his campaign against Mary Landrieu, who cast the key vote for the Affordable Care Act, it was, you know, she voted with Barack Obama, I won't. And so, you know, he kind of, I would say, I think he kind of had an assigned position that he was supposed to take as a Republican. And part of it is that. To hear him talk, he really focuses on the idea of mandates. So, you know, it could be that he does have a philosophical problem with that. Again, I don't know. It's interesting, in kind of earlier incarnations of the discussion, he has talked very negatively about the mandate that everybody carry insurance. But unlike some other Republicans, he's basically said, look, I'm for more coverage, and here are some other ways we can do it. One of the ideas he's pushed repeatedly that wasn't in this recent bill was you know, kind of an opt-out provision that everyone is automatically signed up for health insurance, but they have the opportunity to opt out, which is, you know, kind of a mandate light, I would say. So, you know, traditionally he has really not been a boilerplate conservative Republican on this issue, really until very lately.
Well, he is a man who knows health care, and exactly. He made Obamacare the principal issue in the 2014 campaign against Senator Landrieu, and it worked.
Right, and we should say, you know, not only was he a physician, he was a physician in the charity system, so he is very familiar with the population kind of that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, no doubt about it. But this bill, according to many who have analyzed it, would have hurt Louisiana, his home state, as far as the funding the state gets. Mm-hmm. But yet he went forward with it, and it had his name on it. It didn't seem to be the type of bill that he would have been in favor of a few months ago.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the kind of ironic things here is that this bill rewarded states that did not expand Medicaid and kind of took money away from the states that did and gave it to the states that didn't in the name of kind of, quote, equity. That was a phrase that one of his co-sponsors, Ron Johnson, used a lot from Wisconsin. And, of course, the irony is nobody did anything to these states. These states chose not to take the money when
right.
they didn't expand Medicaid.
And they could take it right now. They could take it now.
Exactly, any day. And, of course, John Bel Edwards did. Bobby Jindal did not. John Bel Edwards did. And in the press conference when the four sponsors were introducing this latest incarnation of the bill, Bill Cassidy pointed to John Bel Edwards as kind of a model. He said, this kicks all the money back to the states. What we need is governors who will really advocate for it, like my governor, John Bel Edwards, so who, of course, did not support this at all.
Well, and Bill Cassidy supported David Vitter for governor as well.
Mm-hmm.
But David Vitter, when he was campaigning, he indicated he would take the money, too.
As did Jay Darden and Scott Angell. And again, I would really look to governors as opposed to members of the Senate and Congress in this case for kind of where the, you know, kind of pragmatic minds are. John Bel Edwards is part of a group led by John Kasich, the Republican from Ohio, has other Republicans in it in addition to Democrats, that's really trying to find a middle ground, you know, fix some of the problems with the Affordable Care Act. Everybody knows there are some. But keep the protections for, you know, that are part of the Affordable Care Act and also just not bankrupt the states.
Well, Senator Kennedy has also had a political epiphany, if you will. He was once a Democrat and and campaigned to the left of another Democrat, Chris John, in the 2004 Senate race. But in the 13 years since, he too has moved toward the right side of the political spectrum. And Senator Kennedy and Bill Cassidy have much in common in that regard, and they're both in their 60s. So this isn't like the other part of their life was a youthful indiscretion. It was a big part of their lives.
That's and a good yet, point, yes.
Yet they are expressing views which I don't think either of them would have thought they would be expressing 10 or 15 years ago.
And I have to, again, you mentioned David Vitter. I think you have to point to the fact that David Vitter became kind of a political patron of both of them.
No doubt.
Vitter is out of office, but he's, you know, kind of his influence, you see it all over the state and certainly the state Republican Party. And perhaps we will be seeing his wife on the federal bench in New Orleans, courtesy of these two senators he helped elect.
Yeah, they both were very supportive of him. I remember seeing a big Vitter sign, in fact, two of them, in Bill Cassidy's yard right at the gates of LSU.
Mm-hmm.
John Kennedy was with Senator Vitter on election night on a night when John Kennedy also was on the ballot. He wasn't even having his own reelection party as treasurer.
I interviewed him that night.
Yeah, he was there with Senator Vitter, went to the mat for him, and now, as you say, both of them are voting very similarly to the way Senator Vitter did when he was in the U.S. Senate for a dozen years.
There is an interesting difference, though, and you brought it up, the fact that they're both now in their 60s. I think Bill Cassidy turned 60 today. And, You know, Louisiana has this long tradition of people who went to Congress and stayed for a long time and built seniority and really built up influence, and that model has completely flipped at this point. I mean, these are we have certainly one of the most junior delegations, one first elected in 2014, one in 2016, and over in the House, a lot of very junior members. The dean of the delegation is Steve Scalise, who's only been there since 2008.
Yeah, not even 10 years.
Yeah.
And the two senators... By biology standards, they're not going to be there as long as Russell Long, who was there for 38
right.
years, or Alan Ellender, who was there for about the same amount of time. And they're not going to be there much, probably as long as Mary Landrieu and John
Mary
Brough.
Exactly.
And John Kennedy is making noises about running for governor. And when I say running for governor, we're talking about running for governor in 2 years, which would mean the announcement would come probably in the next 6 to 8 months. But Stephanie Grace is following all of this. We will talk with her, and if you'd like to join the conversation, you're invited at 877-217-5757. We're back in 90 seconds with more from ACE columnist Stephanie Grace of The Advocate on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Another segment with Stephanie Grace, the fine columnist for The Advocate, formerly with the Picayune, collectively writing columns for 22 years for those newspapers. Your number is 877-217-5757. And also a reminder that this is the third day of the WRKF pledge drive, the membership drive for the fall. And we make the trains roll by receiving contributions from people like you, listeners who give $10, $20 a month so we can maintain the independence it takes to achieve our mission. So contribute by phone at 855-893-9753 or WRKF.org online. 877-217-5757 for Stephanie Grace, and we go to Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Morning. Yeah, Miss Grace, does Cassidy's health care bill indicate that he's more concerned about not letting anyone get his right for the 2020 jungle primary than, you know, the health and well-being of the citizenry as a whole?
That's a really interesting question. You would think on the one hand any Republican in this state would probably have an easy time running for election, but you know, we have the jungle primary, as you said. We have this kind of crazy system where somebody could run to the right, and then if a strong Democrat runs, that's a big question mark, if there would be a strong Democrat, he could get squeezed. You know, it's the Buddy Romer situation. Is that at the top of his mind? I don't know at this point. I mean, I think there are other states where we've seen more of that, certainly Alabama right now, all eyes on Alabama. But that could be a factor. You know, I kind of feel like this was the last chance. Obviously, the deadline for reconciliation is September 30th, and, you know, he was picking up on the fact that the party kind of didn't really care what passed. They just wanted to pass something, and this was something they could cobble together with enough other support, you know, which doesn't necessarily speak for somebody sticking to their principles, but that, you know, it seemed like it was maybe an attempt to do something kind of pragmatic under this very strange circumstances. But of course, that's always a possibility. And it's, you know, remember Rob Manus tried to run to his right when he ran against Mary Landrieu. Didn't get so far, but it'll be different circumstances next time.
Now, a listener asks about the Jimmy Kimmel test. Did the bill that Senator Cassidy sponsor with Lindsey Graham, did it pass the Jimmy Kimmel test?
It did not. I think that's pretty clear. Certainly Jimmy Kimmel, who I would argue should have a say in what the Jimmy Kimmel test should be. You know, Phil Cassidy kind of took his name and used it. And, you know, during one of his very scathing monologues last week, Kimmel said, you know, you used it for your publicity. That's what happened. I mean, nobody knew who Bill Cassidy was before a few weeks ago. Everybody knows who Jimmy Kimmel is. But, you know, what they're talking about is that the bill, basically it kicked health, you know, every state was supposed to come up with its own system. And there were provisions in the bill that basically said the state could get waivers from some of the protections that are now in the Affordable Care Act, and those would include pre-existing conditions, essential benefits, that's the requirement that certain things be covered, maternity, drug treatment, things like that, hospitalization, and lifetime limits could be in there. And, you know, Cassidy insisted that was wrong. He said that the language in the bill provided enough protection, but really, as Kimmel said, just about every expert who looked at it thought it was it did not provide that much protection, and that given the that less money would be coming to the states compared to projections now, not less absolute, but less compared to if we stay in the same course, the states would have to make cuts. So, he insisted that was not the case. I think the preponderance of the evidence is that it would not have passed the Jimmy Kimmel test. And Jimmy Kimmel said, stop using my name. So he certainly thinks so.
Right. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on Talk Louisiana with Stephanie Grace.
Good afternoon. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Ms. Grace. I follow your column. And also, the Advocate, I think, does a pretty good job. My question is this. I'm really not terribly surprised about the conversions, like almost a religious conversion. It seems like any politician that goes to run for office as a Republican becomes, you can basically predict what they're going to say. I am disappointed that John Kennedy, who knows better, is coming out with this same trope about lowering taxes. Now, my question is, the Advocate, can you do polls about what the majority of Louisiana citizens would like to do? I mean, does our state support Obamacare? And, what direction do we want to go in?
All right.
Thank you.
That's an interesting question. We don't, polls are expensive, so we don't do them very often. And I don't know that, and when you bring up taxes, it's kind of hard to get a poll that doesn't say people want to cut taxes, because in a vacuum, of course, everybody wants to cut taxes. It's the trade-offs. On Obamacare, I believe there have been polls that show that specific pieces of it are very popular. Medicaid expansion, certainly the pre-existing condition protections. Off the top of my head, I believe those would be LSU polls from the last couple of years. One measure is just kind of what you hear. I mean, Bill Cassidy, to his credit, held quite a few town hall meetings this summer when he was pushing his earlier version of the bill with Susan Collins, who ended up voting, being against his final version. And, in some pretty conservative places, in St. Tammany and, I think Denham Springs, and places where his voters are. And it was really interesting to see who showed up, that, the passion was all on the side of preserving these protections, these kind of hard-won protections, and Medicaid funding, which was, not even a question in the original ACA, but became a question in the repeal. And, you didn't have the people, stand up and demand that they get rid of it. I mean, I didn't really see anybody do that at the meetings I went to, again, in very Republican areas. So, I mean, that to me is a good test of the kind of temperature of it on both sides. I have to say that once Barack Obama was gone, I think a lot of the passion against this disappeared. That just kind of looking at the landscape, and when you talk, there are, people maybe don't like the idea of big government, and they don't like some provisions of it, and they don't like the fact that it was passed on a party vote. But we all have pre-existing conditions, or know somebody who does. We all know people who have disabled children. We all, this is something that's so intensely personal to people that I think when you throw around phrases like choice and freedom, it doesn't really have much of an impact.
All right. This story has been percolating in the last few hours. House Majority Whip Steve Scalise is returning to work at the Capitol. He'll appear on C-SPAN later today. He's also going to be on 60 Minutes Sunday night, but that is good news. It was June 14th, the day he was shot, so it's been 3.5 months, and we certainly are pleased to see the return of Congressman
Absolutely.
Scalise.
Yes.
Another listener, and this we'll have to address it briefly, Stephanie, but another listener asked about your columns about Mike Yenny, the embattled president of Jefferson Parish, replicating the Oval Office. What is going on there?
Well, If you go into his office, actually, this is based on a story that my friend David Hammer at WWL-TV did. I should say up front, the taxpayers did not pay for the Oval Office replication, the furniture and the rug and everything. They did pay for some pretty expensive other renovations. But his office really looks, if you line up photos of George W. Bush's Oval Office, the furniture, the rug with the kind of big sunburst, the presidential seal versus the, you know, his name, Yenny's parish president's seal. It's almost an exact replica. And, you know, what I wrote is, if I'm Mike Yenny after kind of surviving this recall attempt and the sexting scandal, maybe I want to be a little humble. This is not humility.
Well, what was it Mac Davis said? It's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. Stephanie, always a pleasure to talk with you, and keep up the good work. We'll be in touch soon. Appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good morning.
We ask for your contributions. Please give us a call, 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753, and we're back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number for the show is 877-217-5757 in Baton Rouge. You can dial 297-5633. And a reminder that on day three of the fall membership drive, we'd like to get your support. If you're thinking about becoming a member of WRKF, this is an opportunity to show your support in a tangible way by giving us a call at 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. We're joined now by Paul Kibble. His book is Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Good morning, Paul Kibble.
Good morning. Good to be with you this morning.
And Paul is an award-winning author, has been a social justice activist for many years, about 40 years, and his book has received plaudits from people like Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who says it's a great book written with insight and courage. You say there's a long tradition, Paul, of white people opposing racism, but making all kinds of excuses for not getting involved.
Correct. That history is something we need to build on, but there's always been some white people, and we can use them as role models. But so many of us, basically we're against racism in general. But when asked, well, what are you doing about it? How are you responding? How are you addressing the issues in the community? There's a silence because many white people want to make a difference, but they're not actually involved.
It is interesting that here in the community where I live, I see a lot of my friends making comments about what happened in Charlottesville for good reason, but basically ignoring what's going on in their backyard as far as prejudice and racism. It's a lot easier to take shots at people you'll never encounter, isn't it?
It certainly is. And, you know, I grew up thinking that racism was something that happened only in the South, and out here in California, it didn't happen. I quickly learned that racism is in all of our communities, although when polls are taken of white respondents, they over half say that racism may be a problem some places, but not in my community. And we have to realize that in our school systems, in our healthcare system, in the segregation in housing in our neighborhoods, and the treatment of police of people of color, that racism is definitely a factor in each of our communities.
You say nobody needs a fly-by-night ally.
Correct. I mean, that's the thing about situations like Charlottesville and other more prominent situations is we may respond, we may get angry or upset, but then when the headlines fade from our everyday lives, we go back to business as usual. So we need to not get caught up in those dramas so much, just look at the everyday way that racism plays out in our lives, families, neighborhoods, communities, schools, religious institutions, etc.
Well, we have a lot of misconceptions about race, and when white people start talking about race, some people raise their eyebrows and say, well, what do you know about it? Is there some truth to that?
I think, we're given a lot of misinformation about our history in schools and in the media, and so a lot of us do have misconceptions or are ways that we minimize or deny that racism is a major problem. One of those ways is that we focus on individual relationships and individual acts, so that if somebody makes a racial comment or there's an individual act of racial profiling or a hate crime, that's what we focus on, and we don't dig deeper and see that our institutions are built on inequality and disproportionate access to resources, and therefore we have to look at not just the individual acts, but the institutional patterns and systems that are in place that really hold it together.
877-217-5757, if you'd like to join the conversation with Paul Kibble. His book is Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. There's still many more white people in the United States than there are people of color. So is a majority race. Does that make it tantamount for the majority to perhaps make the first move when it comes to resolving these issues that are still permeating in our society?
Well, it's not so much the first move, because people of color are resisting and challenging racism in all aspects of our society. And we've seen this at Standing Rock. We've seen this in the Fight for 15 for Living Wage. We've seen it in the organizing of domestic workers and farm workers, and then Black Lives Matter and other resistance, and young immigrants that are challenging the deportations. So it's about us stepping up and joining what's already in motion, and adding our voices, our energy, our resources to that struggle. There's plenty to do. It's not just that we have an obligation to people of color. It's that we benefit from racism. If we think about who makes our clothes, who makes our computers and cell phones, who grows and cooks the food and prepares the food that we eat, cleans our buildings, people of color, the contributions of people of color and immigrants of color to our lives is dramatic. And therefore, we have a reciprocity, a mutual interest in actually working to build a different kind of society.
You note that it should be clear that racism has devastating costs to people of color and to white people.
Right. And I think one of the ways we need to look at that is by looking at the economic picture. And we have tremendous inequalities of wealth in this country, and our corporations, our political parties are run by people with tremendous wealth. And one of the ways they keep our attention away from the concentration of wealth is by aiming our attention at recent immigrants or Muslims or African Americans or Native Americans, that we're divided from our natural allies as poor, working, or middle-class white folks, and end up supporting a system that actually works to our detriment as well as to that of people of color.
All right, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org for social activist Paul Kibble. His book is Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Here's a question from Tracy at the Capitol regarding misconceptions. What's the biggest misunderstanding that white people generally have about people of color?
Well, it's not so much about people of color as it is about racism, I think. It's still a majority of white people think that racism isn't a very big problem. It's not a major problem in our society. And yet it impacts all aspects of our lives, where we work, where we live, where we shop, how we're treated, who gets opportunities and who doesn't. So the first misconception, I think, at a basic level is that this racism is a central factor of our lives in this country. And until we address that, we can't also address other issues of inequality, like the economic, lack of jobs and housing and health care that so many of us face.
Are we seeing some of these issues on display in a vivid way in this dispute over standing or kneeling for the national anthem by the NFL players?
Well, it's a symbolic situation, I think. But, you know, the situation is an attempt once again, over and over again, by people of color to bring attention to the racism in our communities. And in this case, particularly the way people of color are treated by the police and other public servants. You know, it's being dismissed because it's redefined as a question of patriotism. But people who are kneeling are very patriotic. They want better things for our country. They realize that we have problems, and they're calling our attention to those problems. We should be thankful for that. But instead, we say they have no respect for the flag or the country, when in fact we're in some sense shooting the messenger rather than solving the problems we have.
You have a chapter called "I'm Not Racist," and you note that many people, almost all people, will say that, and they usually say similar things.
Right. And I think it's not so much about whether an individual is racist or not. I'm not concerned about that. We each have a responsibility to step up and be part of the struggle for racial justice. But the bigger question is, what's going on in our society, in the institutions and policies and practices, the way people are treated in stores, for instance, or in schools, and the lack of opportunity and the mean-spiritedness against and violence against people of color. So the question, it's natural when racism is brought up for us to say, well, it's not me. I'm a good person. I'm innocent. I'm not racist. All those things that we say as white people, but that's really a little beside the point, because it's not about you or me in the bigger picture. It's about what are we doing to change things, to address the issues that are keeping us stuck in huge levels of lack of housing, lack of basic food, lack of health care, things like that.
Well, we're going to talk more with Paul Kibble, and if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 877-217-5757. The book is Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Dr. Eddie Moore of the White Privilege Conference says this edition is challenging, informative, practical. You'll finish the book and want to get right to work. It is a book with some suggestions on how we can address these simmering issues in our country and in our community. And a reminder that this is fall pledge drive time, and we'd like to hear from you at 855-893-9753, or you can go to wrkf.org and make a contribution. Your contributions are what make the programs go and the trains roll at 89.3, and have done so for almost 38 years. 855-893-9753. We're back in 2 minutes with more from Paul Kibble. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing. This is Talk Louisiana, and your number is 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Paul Kibble. His book is Uprooting Racism, and then we'll hear from Kim Nazarian. She's performing tonight at the Manship Theater along with New York Voices, part of the River City Jazz Masters series. The book, as I noted, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Paul Kibble's been doing research on this for 40 years, and in the community where we live, we have largely segregated neighborhoods. We have segregated churches, fraternities, sororities, country clubs, offices, and yet many people believe they're not prejudiced. Is it possible to live in what amounts to an all-white experience and not be prejudiced in some way, Paul Kibble?
Well, I think that those segregated spaces are not accidental. They're not just people mutually deciding to live by themselves or with people like themselves. It takes a lot of effort to keep people out of those spaces. So when we see, as a white person, if we're in a segregated neighborhood, there's a history there of people of color either not being allowed in or being forced out if they were there. The same thing with our schools, with our country clubs, for sure. All of our institutions have been created through processes of active exclusion and marginalization. So we may not be aware of that. We may not personally feel animosity towards people of color, but if we're living in these segregated situations, or if our children are in school that treats young people of color differently than white students, then we're colluding with it. Our silence is complicity with the status quo. And I think that that's one of the first things we need to do as white people is to break the silence, to start talking about racism. How is it playing out in our neighborhoods? We don't talk with our neighbors. We don't talk with our coworkers. We don't talk to our children about racism and how it works in our society and in our lives. And that allows it to just to continue on. So one of the first steps for white people is to break that silence, to start talking to other white people about what's going on, to find out more about what is the history of segregation in our communities.
Well, maybe to do more than talk, to actually move
exactly.
out of these neighborhoods. Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on the air with Paul Kibble.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. I want to congratulate Mr. Kibble on his comment about this was not a Southern phenomena. So many people think that racism is really down here, being an ex from Michigan originally and working for a multinational corporation. We were racist back then in the late 50s, early 60s. And it is something that is everywhere from the northern borders to the southern borders, and it really has to be addressed.
All right. Thank you, Ray. Your thoughts, Paul?
Thank you for your comment. I think that's so true. And as white people, our responsibility is not to respond or blame people in other parts of the country, but to look in our own neighborhoods and workplaces and the organizations that we're part of. That's where our work is, and that's where we have the most leverage. That's where we have the connections. That's where we can start the conversations. That's where we can look at the organizational practices of racial difference that are acted out there. So I think it's very important for us to think globally, but to act locally in our own communities.
Well, Paul Kibble, congratulations. An updated version. This, by the way, is the fourth revised version with new information, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. It's been a pleasure, Paul.
Thanks. I wrote the book as a toolbook of information, resources, exercises, questions, and stories, and practical suggestions to help white people get involved and start to make a difference. Thanks for having me on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And a reminder that you can contribute to the WRKF Fall Membership Drive at 855-893-9753. That's 855-893-9753. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us, and we're joined by a fabulous vocalist for the past 25 years. Ken Nazarian has been harmonizing all over the world with New York Voices. In 2012, she was recognized as one of the top 50 most influential Armenian artists and inducted into her high school's Hall of Fame. And she is in Louisiana in a big way tonight at the Manship Theater. Tomorrow night, she'll be performing at Loyola in New Orleans, and Saturday, she will be in Lafayette. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. It is my pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, tell us a bit about this quarter-century voyage you've had. You have made the rounds and have received great plaudits, and people know you, and I think you have quite a substantial audience in places like Louisiana.
Oh, yeah. I mean, birthplace of jazz. And to put the record straight, the New York Voices have been together for 29 years, and we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary February 2nd.
Very good. So you've been doing this a little while, and you have an interesting backstory. Where did it all start for you?
Well, three of us, Peter, Darman, and I, went to Ithaca College in upstate New York, and we were under the direction of our mentor, Mr. Dave Riley, in a vocal jazz ensemble there. And that's where the roots of the group came from. From there, Dave was invited to do a performance at the North Sea Jazz Festival in Holland and Montreux in Switzerland. And he brought an alumni group of which Peter and I and Darman were in. And after the wonderful response we got in Europe, we decided to keep this going on a professional level. And we started in New York, and within a year we had a record contract, and within the next year we had an agent, and we were off and running.
There are
at that point.
Go ahead.
At that point, we were a five-member group, and in '92 there was a personnel change, and that's where we met our current member, Lauren Kinnon, and she went to Berklee College of Music in Boston.
There are not many people who do what you do any longer, and those who do are not nearly as accomplished as you in most cases. What makes a great jazz singer?
What makes a great jazz singer? I think passion for the genre and being familiar with what's come before and trying to define what it is that you'd like to do under this umbrella to leave some sort of lasting mark. It is part of American history, and it also has to penetrate and resonate with people. And I think if we can touch the audiences of all ages, which we have, I mean, we have a camp, and we work with kids as young as 14 years old, and we have people in their 80s coming to hear us. So we love this multi-generational contact. And I think as long as you can take from and give back to the art form, I think you've done your job as a jazz artist.
Well, some of the places that Kim has performed include Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, the Kennedy Center, Montreal Jazz Fest, as well as going to Brazil, Germany, Armenia, Colombia, France, Holland, Indonesia, Japan, Norway, and many other countries. What makes a good venue for the kind of performance you do?
A full venue. yeah, actually having an audience and having people like you and all the people that do the PR to get the word out so that people actually know who we are and create an excitement about coming to spend quality 90 minutes with us, you know, sharing this intangible thing we call music. But yeah, we also appreciate beautiful acoustics and a well-run organization. We love being treated well, you know, that's also very nice.
Well, you'll have 325 front row seats tonight at the Manship Theater. It is one of the special places for artists like you, and I'm sure it'll be a full house, but also tomorrow night at Loyola in New Orleans and Saturday in Lafayette. So one of the fine singers, Kim Nazarian, will be in our midst over the next 3 days in the three major cities in South Louisiana. And we thank you for joining us. And I know that despite all these exotic places, you live in Oberlin, Ohio on a 6.5-acre farm. That's an interesting notable.
Yes, I do. I'm an Armenian girl that kind of wanted to be on Little House on the Prairie. My husband, Jay Ashby, has a job. He's a full professor at Oberlin College. And, you know, I'm one of those fortunate musicians that was able to manage to balance and juggle it all. I have a healthy marriage. I have a beautiful 17-year-old son. And now we live on a home with lots of land and lots of space. And it just kind of balances the hectic life that you have for 29 years on the road, and it's been a dream. So, you know, I've been seeing this farm for my whole life, and now I'm there.
Kim Nazarian, magna cum laude graduate of Ithaca College, by the way, and she'll be on stage tonight in Baton Rouge at the Manship Theater. Thank you for joining us today, Kim.
Thank you so much, Jim. A pleasure.
And a reminder that tomorrow, the New York Voices with Kim Nazarian will be at Loyola, and on Saturday at the Acadiana Center for the Arts in Lafayette. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.